Where's your favorite place to take College Game Day? And I say every time, Eugene, Oregon.
Hello and welcome, Duck fans, where and whenever you are watching or listening. This is the Once a Duck podcast, where we bring you up to date with current and former University of Oregon athletes and give you never before heard stories about your favorite teams and moments in Duck history. I'm your host, Nick Cody, former Oregon offensive lineman. With me, as always, my trusty co-host, Samuel Tidrick Smith, and, coming off a Husky hate week that didn't go the way we wanted it to. And you know what? We had a great guest last week who reminded us the ball doesn't always bounce your way. Even though it doesn't, though, Sam, this one sucks.
Yeah, Nick, it feels like for a lot of this season, we as much fun as everyone was having, we were enjoying it. There was a little bit of a feeling of just kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop all season. There seemed to be time and time again just little things that would happen, specifically on defense, where you just went, that could cost at some point, but they're all right with it for right now. Well, it all cost Saturday night hard. It cost very effectively, and it cost hard. And Washington was a much better team than Oregon was for about 60 minutes on Saturday night. Are they in total? I don't know, but for sure they were that Saturday night. They beat Oregon by 3. It felt at times as if it were more than 3 for sure. Oregon looked outworked and outdone at several places, several positions, several aspects of the game. And you can't play like that and expect to win. Oregon didn't beat Washington. They didn't beat Oregon. They didn't beat much of anything except for, the spread.
They definitely beat themselves, but Oregon didn't win. That's the thing. But let's get through. We've got a lightning yellow round. Let's just get out where, Sam, where did you know it was all going horribly wrong? Let's go.
There were several times throughout the afternoon when I knew it was going horribly wrong. Being stuck in traffic on the highway about 2 hours before kickoff felt horribly wrong. That was already off to a poor start. But in terms of the actual game itself, it really felt like one of those days where everything that had been working wasn't. And it was simple as that. The onside kick not going well, a great place to start.
Yeah, well, that's a good one. I knew it a little earlier, getting out of the women's basketball game, realizing didn't have one of my phone chargers. That was my first indication. Then when, we were a little bit late getting over to the stadium, weren't able to get those pregame passes, and we got separated right there at the tunnel. That's when I got nervous, but there were more things for sure.
Well, in terms of actual football, like there really was a moment where it felt as if it was all about to crumble, and did crumble from this moment. And it was about a 3rd and 7, maybe 3rd and 9 in the deep in Washington territory. Oregon decides on this important 3rd down play to run a quarterback draw. And it was at that moment, just mere seconds beforehand, I lean over to my buddy Leland and I say, "Hey, this feels like a quarterback draw and I don't love it right here." And he goes, "Oh God, I hope it isn't." It's exactly what happened. It's the play that led to injury. It's the play that led to that drive dying. And it's the play that really let me know it was not about to go Oregon's way that night.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about it more when we get to the football. I got 20 seconds left. I got a quick one for you. When I knew it for sure was not good vibes is when the Duck came out on a throne. Not the kind of karma you wanted to put out there. I got 10 seconds more, Sam. You got a quick one?
Yeah, let's go with this. The minute that I saw Washington's kicker hushing the entire Autzen crowd, I went, "Oh boy, this doesn't end well from here."
No, you're right. That's a great way to end our lightning yellow round. But hey, props to the Huskies. They came out. They played a great offensive game plan. Penix came out. Really was pretty comfortable. There was one sack. should have been dead to rights, but kept him clean, you know, and at the end of the day, our defense could not shut down the best passing offense in the country, but it seems haven't really been able to shut down any passing offense, even though we were able to outgain the Washington Huskies in total yards, 592 yards to their 522. And time of possession is what I really want to talk about, is because Lanning legitimately just decided we can't play with our defense. We're just going to have to play bully ball, use the amount that we've been able to effectively rush against the Huskies and control the clock, because their offensive pass game was only going to stop itself.
Well, what I found so incredible about this game is that from an offensive perspective, fine, look at the last probably two drives don't make up a very fair picture. One is with a backup who it looks like is going to get a lot more run moving forward. And the next one was with an injured Knicks just trying to get within field goal range. By the way, you knew when that illegal touching call came out that it really wasn't going to go anybody's way. That was the last nail in the coffin, you could say. But my goodness, offensively, from a rushing perspective, Oregon did everything they wanted to in that game. Bucky Irving and Noah Whittington combined for over 250 yards rushing together. That's incredible. 19 carries, 143 for Bucky Irving. 20 carries, 108 and a touchdown for Noah Whittington. Both guys had incredible ball games. The Oregon offense moved the ball exactly the way you would think they would want to on the ground. It just came down to the fact that once they scored, when they had to give the ball back to Washington, there was no doubt the Huskies were going to be able to go down and score themselves. That means that at the end of the game, when you do have a drive that's a four and out in Washington territory, they're going to score right there and probably not leave you enough time to really get down the field and into position.
Oh, man. And, you know, even when, you know, we were getting down there, we were churning up yards, getting cute in the end zone is something that is so frustrating. Spreading everyone out, bringing them back in to get a procedural penalty when we're already doing all we can to stave off of those in other positions. That's one of those moments that you know, as Coach Lanning says, the coaches got to take their medicine, players got to take their medicine. Man, I know Dillingham's probably really regretting that right now and trying to think about, okay, why, what can we do to create wrinkles in our offense without having to make it more difficult for our players to execute? Because honestly, in that situation, high pressure, everything that's going on, like, man, to put Bo, an experienced quarterback, in that position and still not have it be successful, that's definitely on coaching. And there were just occasions like that. I was sitting in the stands going, all we need right now is Ty Thompson to pull the ball, use his large frame with a forward lean and get what's there. And even if it's a read, even if it's supposed to be if I'm the offensive coordinator, I am basically in my quarterback's ear at that point saying, I don't care what the read is. You know, you have this opportunity. We've been seeing it all day. Especially without Bo Nix out there, man. You really have to think, and you know, the offensive line, you know, gave a little penetration on that play, but I was sitting there in the stands and still the handoff, Noah slips. You're just sitting there going, oh my goodness. As we were running the ball so effectively, it was those key moments that Washington was able to, you know, congrats to them. They were able to get a lot of movement. I mean, their defensive line was playing out of their minds. One of their best games all year. Constantly moving, constantly fighting off blocks, constantly reasserting themselves and getting back downfield to make tackles. And, you know, it kept Oregon from a lot of the big explosive plays that we're used to having, you know, they saved them a few times. And you know, it's just, man, you can't have those back, but you can go and you can focus it with the Pac-12 champions coming in this week in Utah. And you're going to need to be able to execute a lot better than you did in the red zone against Washington.
Well, and we're going to get into the Utah matchup. We're going to break that down a whole lot more fully, but taking a look at this Oregon-Washington game the way we are, there were moments throughout the game that just didn't feel right. It felt as if it was either a decent card that was pulled at the wrong time, or if it was just there were a lot of timing and execution issues throughout the entire day. I have no doubt that we are going to get into the, just frankly put, bad performance from the Oregon defense. There's no other way to put it. You give up 408 through the air and 114 on the ground. No one's looking at you like you're not the reason there was an issue. I mean, Penix had two touchdowns, one of 75 yards, one of 65 yards about. Both just torching the Oregon secondary. You've got Christian Gonzalez, who's been holding down one side relatively effectively, gave up the big play that probably should have been reviewed at least a little bit. But regardless, you allow that play to happen. And then you have other veteran guys who are just making poor decisions while already sitting in a defense that is known to allow things underneath. So look, if you're going to be allowing things underneath, at least for the love of God, keep it in front of you. Don't assume that you're going to have a shot to pick off a ball and then watch it sail over your head to the defender who is already behind you. Don't get yourself in that position. It was a mess all day long. But even if just a couple moments are different, that's a different game. You can make an argument that, hey, what if when you try that onside kick that you tried in the first half, if you don't do that, and credit to the Oregon defense, they took a short field and they held Washington to a field goal. But if that's a drive that starts at your own 25, are you telling me those points are happening before half? I'm not positive they are. Maybe they are. Maybe Penix hits somebody over the top for a 75-yard ball. Totally could happen. Saw one happen right in front of my face. Definitely could have. But also, you're putting yourself in a more advantageous position. After the game, DeBoer said about that specific play, we just saw some numbers in some places they shouldn't have been on that onside kick, and it gave us some intel, gave us a heads up. Yeah, that's exactly what's going to happen. Once you have that play on tape like you do against UCLA, everybody's going to be looking for it, and just seeing numbers in different places on that alignment is going to let you know what you need to know. They were very ready for that. Moving on to later in the ballgame, Oregon, I think rightfully so, took some field goals in some times where they could have, and it made sense to. Even the one at the end of the half for Camden, thought it was fine, thought it was fair enough. You don't get it, oh well, you get it, awesome, good for him. Moving on to the second half, though, there were several moments of just kind of sitting there going, we haven't felt this way since week one. It's not that they're stopping the thing that works. We're trying something cute. We're trying something intricate that we have no business trying right now. And it happened repeatedly throughout that ball game. Finally, the last real moment, if you will, that fourth down, which frankly, given how you'd been running all day, not sure it is a terrible call. It really might. It if that's one of those plays that if it goes well, we're all talking about how amazing it is right now. We really are. Oregon's able to pick up a first down right there. Bo Nix comes in immediately afterwards. Oregon probably is able to get into field goal range. Camden Lewis, I trust he's going to hit it if it's inside of 50. I really do. But that's not what happened. Noah Whittington slipped. You could make an argument that with half a yard to gain, it's silly to bring the ball back 3 yards to hand it off to the running back like that anyways. It is silly to put an offensive line that has experienced a couple of injuries throughout the game the kind of pressure they were going to get. But it's what happened. It's what Oregon did. And that's the kind of game that I think we were expecting, because Oregon does this in November, but also you have a new head coach. You've got a guy in his very first season being a head coach, surrounded by people in their very first season doing what they do. You're going to have growing pains. You're going to have problems. If a 3-point loss in November is your growing pain, okay, we'll take it. That happens. But unfortunately for this game, it's not just 3 points and one loss in November. The loss of a potential Heisman contending quarterback, a couple of offensive linemen that have been Pac-12 offensive linemen of the week in their career. It was a costly one. It was a costly one.
Well, and you know, you get down into November, and like I've said in previous episodes leading up to this, you're going to deal with injuries. There's going to be things that happen, whether it results in people, you know, losing game time over it, or it's just the nicks and dings and bruises that come up that you see that happen with, you know, I felt so bad for Forsythe out there. Some of those snaps, you know what it's like when you've been grinding through the season and you're just trying to do all you can out there and you have the responsibility of the football, man, that's a tough job. Another tough job, and you already touched upon it, is being a kicker. And kicker, our special teams did not have a special day. You know, the field position that you lose with a kick out of bounds, I don't think you can explain that enough, just to how frustrating that is to lose those extra yards. And to that other team, how bigger their eyes get on that prize of not just kicking a field goal, but we're that much closer to the end zone now. So let's get out there and get seven is what you're thinking. And man, that's what the game came down to. Oregon settling for, you know, a three in that fourth quarter. And then basically the rest of the way, Huskies were able to move the ball on us. And we weren't able to answer in those key moments. And, you know, it happens. This team has to learn from it. Lanning just getting into double digit games as a head coach now, hopefully, and from everything it sounds like on his end, he's learning from this as best he can to take it and put it forward. And hopefully we never have to deal with talking about some situations like some of these again. But again, this is November. This is Oregon football. We've been here before. I've heard a lot of comparisons, you know, especially now, you know, we'll mention it, I guess, pretty clearly. Chris Hudson comes out the other day and mentions Bo being down and them being, you know, in full faith of Ty and Butters getting out there. So a lot of people assuming Ty Thompson might get the start this week. Bo might not be able to go. And then, you know, all things withstanding, he also addressed the end of the game there, the little injury, saying that was a part of the game plan. So I don't know if we still have any headsets laying around to throw at Chris, but man, I was sitting there thinking, man, I really hope this is the best ploy, the best smokescreen we've ever seen in Oregon football interviews, but it doesn't seem like it is. So I'll ask you first and foremost, how are you feeling about that? You know, if Bo can't play?
Well, you know, I'm going to put this out there like this, because there's a chance everything reaches everybody, which you should always account for. And I'll say this. I really, really, really like what Chris Hudson brings to this Oregon offense. I really like it. He is quick. He is nimble. He is agile. He has an amazing center of balance. He has made some catches this season that I did not think he had any business making. He has made some people miss tackles that I thought were just incredible. He really does have some of like the most explosive, entertaining plays of the year. But as far as that interview moment was concerned, I don't think it was quite as shining as any of those plays that I was talking about. I don't think it was as sterling, you could say. I don't know if it shone the way you would hope it might shine. You probably shouldn't mention anybody's injury. Probably not even your own, really, if you're in that setting, but you shouldn't especially mention somebody else's. And well, you probably shouldn't admit that you're sitting on the ground faking a cramp, because it's, quote, part of the game plan. It's not generally something that is positive to put out there, especially with how much people love to grab onto any little thing. Even though, and let's be very clear about this, any football team in that position has said that at some point. Almost any team is going, look, if we need the clock stop, you get a cramp. That's how this goes, right? And is there a difference between doing it to slow down an opponent's offense versus doing it to stop the clock for your own? Maybe there might be a semantic thing to get into there, but at the end of the day, just wasn't a great interview moment. Wasn't a great interview moment at all. One that I'm guessing Chris wishes he could have back. One wish that I know Lanning knows he could have back. I don't think Dan Lanning's the type of guy to yell at somebody and have it become a meme the way Cristobal did on the sideline. But I guarantee you that same thing happened behind the scenes. Let's put it that way. Now on to the Bo Nix aspect of this whole thing, right? for a while this season, since about September, I was saying, I don't know why this year feels weirdly 2011-ish. It does. A big loss at the beginning of the year, followed up by a lot of great play, and then something that goes awry late in November, right? And I made a mistake in that assessment. I made a mistake, and it was such a glaring mistake that now I have a hard time surviving it, right? And it's the fact that every single person who knows anything about college football has agreed that this has been the wildest year since 2007. It really has been, in terms of the turmoil, the turnaround, the wins, the losses, the big games, the craziness, the amount of upsets we've seen. 2007 is what this equates to. The last time Kansas was any good. The last time the Big 12 had a legitimate title contender. The last time a lot of craziness occurred was 2007. And boy, oh boy, Oregon Ducks 2007. All of a sudden, this is lining up just a little bit better than I would hope it would. A loss early in the season that you've grown past, followed up by a quarterback who's on track to at least show up in New York being injured, and then the rest of the season feeling real iffy. I think that that's avoidable. Even one win in the next two games puts you at a somewhat decent chance of making the Pac-12 title game. Seven wins, a lot of scenarios in which Oregon gets there with seven wins. A lot more scenarios Oregon gets there if they beat Utah. Whole lot more scenarios. Do I think it'll happen? We'll see when predictions come, but you're losing a Heisman caliber quarterback. There's no replacing that.
Yeah, and you're certainly right. And I mean, again, all speculation until we know, and we can expect Oregon will probably put Bo out there on the screen, list him as a starter, regardless of if he can go or not, because this is football. That's gamesmanship. I'm sure Utah knows it's coming. They're well coached. You know, it that'll happen. But yeah, this team, if Bo is gone for the season, it is unfortunate. It does. Like I said, there's plenty of comparisons. Duck fans have seen bits of this before, but I do like your comparison to, you know, that 2011 Rose Bowl season, because you start off the season with an SEC opponent that, you know, is really a competitor for the title. And then that, you know, down the season, you lose one. But one I compare it even more to is probably that 2019 season that ended at Rose Bowl. Very, very similar. Start off with an SEC opponent, a neutral site area. You know, lose that game down at ASU, that right when you think you're in that playoff contention, and that those whispers are out there and everybody's discussing what's it take to get there, and all of a sudden you lose that one game. But hey, here's the opportunity to get, you know, the train back on the rails. You know, nothing is gone at this point. Everything that was still right there in front of you is right there. All those dreams of the playoff, you weren't in the top four. You didn't lose anything there. You've lost some ground in a perception-based, you know, invitational. That's not a playoff. It's not a tournament. So don't even worry about it. We still have everything we need in front of us if we beat our opponent this week. And that's Oregon. Honestly, the biggest thing is going to be, especially if Bo Nix is out, how this team regroups and what their preparation is going to be like for whoever is able to start. If it's Ty Thompson, if it's Jay Butterfield, the preparation that goes into this week. And I'll tell you, when you're running reps with the ones versus the twos, you grow that much more as a player during the week. It's so substantial. The extra amount of reps you get, the extra attention to detail, you know, coaches might let some things go by in a rep with the twos that they may not catch, but the reps with the ones, if you're not executing in perfection, they let you know. And whether it's in the field room or right there on the field, those things don't go unnoticed. And your ability to learn and process from those things, oh, it's not even comparable to when you're down there trying to work with twos, and especially, I imagine, at the quarterback position.
Well, I think the quarterback position is the key to this all, really, whether it's how Dillingham has run his offense all season, whether it's what we know about football in general. That's going to be huge. And I think the one outlying factor between this season and a season like 2019, where you mentioned number 10 never stopped playing that year. If number 10 stops playing this year, that could have an entirely different outcome. And I really do think Bo Nix's availability does mean a lot. I'm not saying that Ty would be incapable of going out there and playing well. Hell, maybe he does. But it's impossible to look at the situation and not at least feel as if there is bound to be something resembling a regression. I really, really hope that this is one of those clips that comes back around on one of those highlight tapes when they talk about the quote-unquote doubters right before somebody goes out and does something amazing, because that means that Oregon football is doing amazing, and I'm very willing to allow myself to be wrong to let that happen. I would love it. But as of right now, it's very, very difficult to feel anywhere near the same level of confidence that you felt about these last stretch of games the way you felt a week ago. It's very, very difficult. I don't know if it's the same level of difficulty in that locker room. I sure as heck hope not. I hope they feel just as confident as they did a week ago. We'll have to see how that plays out, though.
Yeah. Well, and I think there's been a lot of talk in previous weeks leading up to this. You know, what if Bo Nix stayed another year, which I kind of find absurd with the year he's had, unless he really believes that coming back, you know, playing, you know, another season, risking his body that much more would give him a better opportunity at the pro career. Man, I don't know how the NIL figures would balance out there, but I think you need a pretty significant compensation package to come back at this point. And if you're Oregon and you are trying to figure out who's the future quarterback, this is an opportunity right here. And I the thing that I see very, very different is that this is an offense that not only has the weapons, but knows how to utilize them much more than previous offenses, I think. And I don't think, you know, the thing with 2007 comparisons is our wide receiver corps was decimated. Man, if we had just, you know, a single Troy Franklin on that team, I don't know. Maybe, you know, Brady Leaf steps in there, gets it done. Maybe one of those guys is able to come in, close up the season. Maybe even Nate Costa gets in there healthy somehow and slings a few around. I don't know. But there were so many more injuries than just Dennis in that 2007 season. So that's where that comparison, I'm like, man, I feel a lot better this time at least. But, hey, it's really tough knowing that you have an opponent like Utah coming in, of all people. If it were a situation like that season, you know, having to go down to UCLA and stuff, this season probably wouldn't feel too great about that either. But, I think this is going to be a test. It's going to be a really great opportunity for both teams. Right now, both of these teams, number 10 and 12 rankings. This is going to help somebody's resume, and somebody's probably going to get themselves into the, you know, this is their the path to the Pac-12 championship game. So I'm excited for it. I know a lot of people are starting to have their doubts just because of the concerns at quarterback. But, man, I'm excited to see how this team responds, because they've been playing for each other this season.
Well, the last thing I'll really say about it for right now, because we have a guest to get to, we have a lot of show to get to, we have this coming week to get to. The last thing about Washington and Oregon from this past weekend is just pure credit to Washington. Yeah. They came in with a great game plan, offensively and defensively. They executed. They were better in the trenches. They were better outside the numbers. They were better downfield. Hell, they whooped Oregon's ass on Twitter. They won everywhere that Washington could win this weekend. They absolutely won, and there is nothing left to do but bitterly stare at your rival and go, all right, we're coming back for you next time.
Yep, right up there in Autzen North next year. But hey, right, again, can't do anything about it. And you know, the only thing you can do is make sure it doesn't beat you twice, which is what Lanning said. What, you know, any good coach would say. But, you know, we've seen them bounce back from the Georgia game, but it's going to be a whole lot different story than Eastern Washington. And you mentioned our guest. I'm very excited for this one and get our spirits lifted a little bit, change the energy, because here at Once a Duck, we love to give you guys not just great guests, but unique and interesting ones. And, we love talking gear and equipment. So figured, why not get one of my former equipment managers on the show? So that's what we did. With us now, and a guest I'm very excited for, someone you will not hear anywhere but Once a Duck, former equipment manager, Brett Sandy Moyer. Sandy, you know, first and foremost, I got to get it out there. Before we talk about your time inside the program, got to say, man, my first catch in Autzen Stadium officially with you as quarterback. I got to thank you for that perfect throw. I burned Mark Asper right off the line at the beginning of the 2017 spring game halftime crap show that was our flag football game. But hey, great throw, great times, and you got that touchdown to Jeff Mill. What was that like?
Man, that was so much fun. You know, I've grown up going to games in Autzen Stadium. I spent 10 years on the sidelines, and it's every kid's dream to play football in Autzen Stadium in front of people. As an equipment manager, I've never got to do something like that. A neat opportunity to go out there and actually play with you guys. It was a lot of fun. I mean, I've thrown a lot of balls in practice and, done that, but it's different doing it in front of a crowd, even if it's halftime of a spring game. It was a great experience. And you got Mark Asper off the line so good. Quick feet.
Sandy, it's a pleasure to have you in here. For our audience who might not be as familiar with your work the way they might be familiar with one of our guests who might have spent a little bit more time in the uniforms that you got to work with all that time. Tell us a little bit about when you were at Oregon, what was going on campus around that time, and the state of the Oregon program.
Sure. I came on as a freshman and student equipment manager for the 2001 season, which all fans are going to remember as the Fiesta Bowl season. Joey Harrington's Heisman campaign, Bill Ward up in Square. That's when I started my career. The program at that time was on the up and up. They had gone to, three bowl games previous to that, where each season they had gotten better in wins. They'd won the bowl game. And so coming in my freshman year, going to the Fiesta Bowl, finishing number two in the nation, there was a little controversy there, as there is so often with the BCS or the college football playoffs. But neat time to start. And then there was, it dipped off there for a little bit and then came roaring back. But, when I started, there was one practice helmet, one green game helmet per player. And in my time there, we expanded uniforms. We went from one game helmet to five game helmets. We expanded a locker room. We expanded the equipment room. We expanded inside the stadium. So there was a lot of stuff happening in my time there.
Now, one thing I remember about your time there is how much, man, people used to just hassle you for gear. What is the best line you ever heard from somebody that just get a piece of equipment that it's like, come on, you don't need that?
Oh, man. Well, let's see. I remember one of the years, we have walk-on tryouts once school starts. But for those of the people that are scholarship or preferred walk-ons where they've been on the team since August, we're already 6 weeks into the season. And I remember we got a walk-on kicker, where he would have joined the team on, let's say, a Wednesday, and we're playing a home game on Saturday. And he came in the locker room asking for sleeves and wanting to dress down I was just kind of beside myself because it's game day and I'm focusing on taking care of the team, but this guy that I don't know is walking in wanting to get everything. But he ended up getting it. I initially had told him no. And then, I had a little talking to from Coach Rad saying he needs to dress. And, that particular player went on and had a good career for us and played for many years as a kicker. But there's another story. I remember Lake Seastrunk coming in on his recruiting trip, and he was talking about how he just wears one glove. That was his thing. I wear one glove. And I don't know why that stuck out. I mean, I just remember it being silly, but guys have their things that they do to be successful, and if that helps them getting in the mindset, then so be it.
Sandy, you joined during that
2000. Oh, we had another player too, a lineman who. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, finish up.
Oh, I was going to say we had an offensive lineman before your time, Nick, where his one size foot was like a size 16, and then his other size foot was like a 14 and a half. So we had to do two pairs of cleats for him. His feet were so different size that it wasn't like it was just a little bit where you could get away with one pair of cleats. He had to have two separate pair of cleats so that his right foot and his left foot matched up.
Sandy, considering that you started in the 2001 season, you went on from there. You were there right as Nike was imprinting the program the way that they have now. What were some of the first things you saw in terms of big changes happening around the program, whether it was facilities, whether it was a new piece of equipment? What was one of the first signs that things were really about to explode for Oregon, at least from that partnership's perspective?
Well, so shortly before I got there, I want to say it was going into the 98 season, Oregon transitioned to those dark green uniforms with the iconic Oregon O that we have now. In my time there, we transitioned out of those into the first new set. So we wore the all yellow uniforms at Mississippi State. That was a big deal. You know, the branding with just player billboard. They don't seem to be doing that as much as they used to, but they used to have player billboards where they'd be up in the streets and, you know, Nike would come in and do photo shoots. It was really an attention to detail everywhere. And it really started with the uniforms and the indoor practice facility. And then the uniforms carried that momentum. The helmets did, you know, the facilities, the facilities were a huge thing. We redid the locker room in 2003 where it went to, it was the same room that it was in, but they turned it into a two-story locker room with three giant plasma screen TVs. I mean, that was huge. And it just, that momentum never seemed to stop, and it just seemed to keep picking up.
Yeah. And what's always been crazy to me looking back at those moments is how we did utilize that little amount of space in the best way possible. And it seemed really, really luxurious, you know, until of course, right now, the HTC and everything they have there, all that equipment. What was it like for you guys trying to manage all that amount of gear in that tiny little room? How did you do it? What kind of things did you kind of have to do to figure that out? And how long does it take somebody, if they come in as an equipment manager, to figure that kind of thing out?
Oh man, it takes years. I mean, when I first started, there was six student equipment managers and three student equipment managers traveled to away games. One of the smallest student equipment staff in the country at that point in time, but we were getting into one of the bigger equipment room as far as the amount of inventory that we had in the country. So, you know, when we were, before we expanded the equipment room the first time, because we kind of did like what the football team did with the locker room, where we took the existing space, added a second floor, that added a little more storage. But, you know, you got to remember when the Casanova Center first opened, there was football, men's wrestling, and soccer out of that building. When I left, we had football, wrestling had just gone out, but baseball had come in, women's lacrosse, women's soccer, team stunt and gymnastics. So, I mean, there was more teams, more gear, same size space. We had to get creative. We put in space savers, and that was just, now they've got them all over the place in the new equipment room, full of space savers. But we started implementing that. The big shipping containers that you would see on, you know, giant cargo ships, we had to have a ton of those brought in, and those were around the outer rim of like the stadium walk around, and those were full of gear and apparel. And, you know, I am the student managers that had to manage that, God bless them, because they're loading that stuff in July and August when it's, you know, 90, 100 degrees outside, and those containers are hot, and they're spending hours in there working, organizing boxes, getting them put in. So we had stuff everywhere. We had game helmets in like storage rooms over in Meshofsky. Some were stored in the Casanova Center. Some were stored out in the storage lockers around the stadium. So it was a lot of, you know, just putting stuff where you could and then just managing it.
Sandy, during that the time frame, the one especially when you were there, Oregon, as we've said, they were just getting into the habit of mixing up the uniform a little bit, being a little bit more creative here and there. I guess my question is, especially when that yellow jersey did come around, that yellow look that was Mississippi State used in years later against Oregon State and against Washington. I guess first off, what was the reaction the first time everybody saw that all yellow, both as an equipment crew and as a greater community? And then building off of that, who was in charge of deciding whether it was going to be green or yellow for those seasons where it was first introduced?
You know, you just gave me goosebumps just talking about it, because I remember it when those new sets of uniforms came out and they had the lightning yellow. Man, it was such a hit with the players. They were so excited. I remember the recruits being super excited. The equipment staff, we were excited. You know, it's new. It's forward thinking. You don't see anybody else in the country doing it. It was so neat. As far as picking the uniforms go, that changed over the years. So when I started, Mike Bellotti was the head coach, and he would leave it up to the seniors to decide what we were going to wear for home and away games. And that was more, you know, when the uniform switched, where we had four different color jerseys, four different color pants. And so the seniors would come in and vote, and that was always kind of a mess. When Chip took over, he had a good relationship with the men's golf coach, Casey Martin. Casey always loved talking about the uniform, so Chip put the men's golf coach in charge of what uniforms we would be wearing. And then since then, I want to say that that's something that's more decided behind the scenes with Nike and with the Oregon coaching staff, where I think, and I don't know this for sure, but I think that they have that mapped out for the season now. They kind of have a plan of what they're going to do.
Now, one of the really cool things about, you know, your job and some exclusive players was the opportunity to test out, you know, new exclusive Nike gear. What was that process like? And explain for people that don't understand, especially with those skill guys that don't get the comfy padded shoes like us linemen, how hard it is for those guys to break in cleats before game day.
Yeah, you know, that was always it was an interesting process to be a part of. It could be a struggle to a certain extent. Because Nike would come down, there'd usually be two or three people from Nike coming down. You know, it could be a couple times in 1 week or a couple times a couple weeks in a row. But, you know, they're bringing down stuff that's not being used in college football for another 2 years, 3 years sometimes with some of their development stuff. And so sometimes you got, you know, we had a set of players that were really into testing stuff. You had other guys that wanted nothing to do with it because they had their routine, their stuff, and they didn't want to mess with that. But then one of the problems could be is sometimes they would have such a good product and the guys would like it so much, they would want to wear it in the game. And, you know, Nike was like, no, this stuff is test. It's prototype. We don't want it out there on national television. And so that could be a struggle sometimes. Players could get sneaky and want to do that anyway, you know, because they're just thinking they're going to get a slap on the wrist, which usually is what happened. But, you know, I remember when we were going down to play in the Holiday Bowl against Oklahoma State, and we had a pair of blue and white tester Jordan cleats. And it was the first time I saw Jordan on football apparel. And Brady Leaf ended up wearing those, and he liked them so much that I had to take like a black Sharpie and color in the blue to black so that they would be white and black cleats, because he was so adamant on wearing them.
I mean, that is a great anecdote right there, just being able to have to use that little cover up, introduce the black bit. And it actually does lead into a question I was wanting to add. You were at Oregon when black became like an official part of Oregon's repertoire. For years, it was just that Kelly green and gold. Then it went to the dark green with the lightning yellow. All of a sudden, black is a part of the mix. And one of my favorite Oregon uniforms of all time that was only used in one game was for the 2005 rivalry game against Oregon State, the prototype version of what became the steel tread uniforms. I guess my question would be, what was the reaction to black in general being introduced into the color scheme? And for that 2005 game against Oregon State, whether it was the shoulders, whether it was the funky number font, what really stuck out about those the most?
just the black at the time. To me, I think black looks so intimidating. And yes, it's not a school color. It's not one of our core colors. But it looked so good with that bright yellow on there. Just so clean. And we kept it a secret from the players till game day. They didn't know. I don't know if you remember that game, but the team came out for pregame warmups wearing yellow, all yellow. And we, as the equipment staff, like, we had a ton of stuff to do to try to prep that so that when guys came in from pregame, they could very quickly get out of their yellow and be in black. So guys were wearing their black pants underneath the yellow uniform. For about half the players, we used like a double-sided carpet tape to tape the jerseys down to the shoulder pads. And that's a very time-consuming thing to do. So we had to get out a bunch of extra shoulder pads so guys could just have their yellow jerseys on there, come back in, take that off, switch into their normal shoulder pad with the jerseys already taped down. But the biggest feeling for me, other than seeing them and pulling them out of the boxes, was going back out onto the field with the players, transitioning from that yellow to that black. And I just thought that was the coolest thing ever. And I know they were only used that one time, but I thought those numbers were cool. They were called duct tape. That was what that was supposed to be. And then the font that they went to after that, they called that Bilotti Bold, where the numbers started wider at the top and then kind of skinnied down. So that was supposed to look guys like Nick Cody that are playing that don't look like a fleshless. It still looks in V, that makes them look V'd out. So just kind of the thought that went into that and all of it, you know, everything has a purpose, and it was just super neat.
Yeah, Nike did their best not to accentuate the gut, but hey, I still managed. Somehow, when there's a will, there's a way.
You look great. I mean, you saw those new pictures for the uniforms we're wearing this weekend on a tackle, man. He looks great.
Exactly. In fact, that's exactly what I wanted to get to next is, you know, the next version of the uniforms, which, you know, I was reminded of a lot with this upcoming week with the white helmets and the white pants and that Rose Bowl debut of that uniform combo. But thinking back when we first debuted, those was also the first time we wore all black. That was my freshman year, 2008, when we were playing Rob Gronkowski and the Arizona Wildcats in an offensive explosion. What do you remember about getting the all blacks and the wings on the shoulder, and what was your reaction to that?
Man, every time the new iteration of uniforms comes out, it's just so exciting because it's, you know, you're at the forefront of college football, and you know that. You know, as we all know that, and that's neat. But then seeing 120 guys, players, you know, react to it where it gets you guys hyped up and ready. It's just exciting, man. I mean, there's already good energy at Austin and within the team, but then you throw in a mix of, like, you know, the new uniform, something where you're just a part of something that's so much bigger than yourself. It's just incredible.
Well, Sandy, we know how important it is for, at least from a marketing perspective, to always have at least a little bit of the surprise there. For the fans' mm-hmm. perspective, for everybody who's watching, for everybody like me who's going to be silly enough to spend real retail dollars on the fan versions of them. I guess my question would be, who were always some of the nosier people around the building when it came to uniforms? Were there specific players that had a little extra interest in it? Were there other members of the staff, other members associated with Oregon Athletics? Who was always trying to butt in and figure out what was going on?
Casey Martin always wanted to know. He was down in the equipment room, and this became before he became the uniform coordinator. As far as players go, I remember Ed Dixon, Pat Chung, Dennis Dixon. Those guys were always, what's going on with these uniforms? Typically, the guys that cared the least were usually the guys in the trenches, the offensive and defensive linemen. Really the specialists, the running backs, the wide receivers, the DBs, they love being clean and getting all done up. You remember the D boys, Patrick Chung, Jarrett Bird, TJ Ward, those guys were all about it. Loved it.
Yeah, well, you know, back in my day, we mostly only had the gray lineman gloves, you know, the old standards. So, it was, and even if we got the nice ones, I didn't want to ruin those, so I just stuck with the old ones. What's something out there that maybe the average football fan doesn't know about, maybe a certain piece of equipment that players like need or don't need, or that maybe was a struggle for you guys in the equipment room to be able to keep up with?
You know, the tough things would actually be when guys were would get injured, but they're playing, and so you would be attaching like arm sleeves that would connect to their shoulder pads that would help keep their arm in place because they had a dislocated shoulder. The rest of the stuff was pretty easy. I was always a big fan of like the cowboy collars. Max Unger wore one as a center that I just absolutely love that. I think it just makes him look bigger and meaner. But those were easy to put on, but as the uniforms progressed, they became much lighter and much tighter. And so getting them on the player became difficult. Like, it became a ritual where there was certain guys on game day that I'm helping them get their shoulder pads over them, get the jersey on over them, where that just became part of like a game day ritual for me. Like, some guys would like to wear their lucky socks or whatever. Well, I had a group of guys that came to me to have their shoulder pads put on, to have their eye black put on, to write, you know, numbers on with Sharpie ink on their arms for players that were injured and not able to play. That game day routine I loved. But going back to testing some of the uniforms, we went from like a spandex, you know, shiny type of material to a Cordura type of material that doesn't retain water. You don't realize how much extra weight a player is carrying wearing wet uniforms. And so that was big, going to a uniform that didn't retain water. I'm not going to name the player, but we did have a player, a linebacker, that really took advantage of that on game days. I mean, he was a big-time player. He didn't like coming out of the game. He did not want to go to the locker room to go to the bathroom. So he'd sit on the bench, you know, take a leak, and the pants wouldn't retain anything. It just goes out and just spray him down with a Gatorade water bottle, and you'd never even know.
Well,
I can
Nick
confirm that. Yeah.
Nick on this podcast has told the stories of especially what happened wearing black or yellow pants. So I'm glad to know that he wasn't completely lying to us about that one. I don't want to take up too much of your time at all, Sandy. I know we've already been talking to you for a while. One more thing that I was kind of curious about that I always noticed, especially being someone who grew up a lot, watching a lot of whether it was the Chip Kelly era, a little of the Mike Bellotti before that, there were always guys who would have their own little things that they would do equipment wise. One that always stuck out to me for the longest for whatever reason was noticing DeAnthony Thomas running down the field with a hood pointing out, coming out the back of his collar, or other guys with various little attributes. What was something that as an equipment manager, a guy who's working toward not only making the guys look the best, making sure they have everything they need, what was something that guys did that just bothered you, that just annoyed you, that just said, why are you doing this to our work?
So for me, I'm kind of I like the team to look the same. So I don't like seeing guys where somebody's wearing black cleats, somebody's wearing white cleats, somebody's wearing green armbands, somebody's wearing yellow armbands. I really like the team look. And there was a time where, before Chip took over, where it was just on a whole, we wore like the same colored jersey and pants. But then as far as accessories and stuff, you know, to go to Pilate, that wasn't important. And so the players could kind of do what they wanted. And that, just from a personal perspective, annoyed me just because I wanted us to look like a team and all the same to a certain degree. So, and then the other thing was Nike got into making visors. Oakley is known for visors on the helmets, but Nike got into it. We're a Nike school, a Nike flagship school. We need to be wearing those Nike visors. And I remember there was a group of players that switched out into Oakley visors before we played at Boise State, Chip Kelly's first year as a head coach. I won't name those players, but I remember that. I remember that really frustrating me because I know that down in the equipment room, I'm going to be getting a call from the coach or from Nike saying, what the hell, guys? Why are your players wearing Oakley? And you're an equipment manager. Why are you allowing that? And really, the players snuck and did it during pregame with stuff that they brought in their travel bags. So That was pretty frustrating. But, you know, other than that, it was a phenomenal experience.
Well, we appreciate you coming on and giving us the peek behind the door. And we'll give you one less intrusive but nonetheless difficult question. What is your favorite Oregon uniform of all time?
Oh, man. Okay, so I really liked the uniform combo that we wore when we played LSU in Dallas, Texas. I thought that was such a good-looking set of uniforms. And then when we debuted, those are my favorite. The next favorite were the Marcus Mariota. I'm trying to remember who we opened that season against. But it was the helmet that you've got next to you over your right
shoulder. Arkansas State.
Oh, man. Yeah. I thought that uniform combo. But that was the first time seeing the wings on the helmet. But it was such a good clean look. But those are my two favorites.
Awesome. Well, we appreciate you coming on with us. And as they always say, once a duck, always a duck. Thank you, Sandy.
I appreciate you bringing me on the podcast. I'm lifelong listening to it since you started, and I'm honored to be a guest on the show.
Well, I mean, that's a great interview to get out of a UW week and get focused on this week. As we mentioned, this week, finally going with the white helmets, white pants. And I got to mention, one of my favorite things as an offensive lineman that we don't talk about enough in the equipment game, white gloves. Going against a team with white jerseys, man, I wish I didn't learn that in my 1 week in the Canadian Football League, because, man, I would have gotten away with a lot more holding calls that nobody would have seen. That's what I love. I love it.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Isn't that an old Belichickism of having your linemen wear the same color gloves as the team you're playing?
I sounds about right. I mean, if it's going to come from any NFL program, it's probably the Patriots. But yeah, I learned that a tip I saw in the CFL, and I knew that Mario Cristobal's alignment were very clearly aware of it, even if it wasn't the gloves, sometimes the tape on there. Yeah, so dark gloves when you're you know, on the road, and then white gloves at home. That's always a strategy I like. And even more importantly than the uniform that, you know, is the guy you're laying hands on. And Utah, man, we're going to have to lay hands on this team. I know it's just one of those teams that no matter what, they're going to bring it to Oregon. They brought it to us last year. They're a physical, tough football team. They've been inconsistent this season, but they're the one team that's beaten USC.
I think Utah rightfully hates Oregon. I think they do. I think it makes sense, and I think it's kind of valid, the hatred, right? Because you go back and you look at, number one, the all-time series. Oregon does have it just because they played Utah so many times when Utah wasn't at this Power 5 level. Then by the time Utah does get to this Power 5 level, Oregon, for basically the entire time the Pac-12 has been the Pac-12, or at least more years than not, it's kind of been the top dog. Since Utah joined the conference, 4 conference championships, several big bowl game appearances, more winning seasons than not, far more. I'm pretty sure all but one more winning seasons than not. A lot of 10 win seasons in there. And for Utah, for years now, they've been wanting to prove that they are the best in the Pac-12. They are high caliber West Coast football. And beating Oregon is how you do that. You do that by beating Oregon. You do that by beating USC. They've already done one of those this year. Utah has so much to prove. And it's not just because they're Utah. They're not originally part of the conference, because they're a little bit further away. It's also because this is a team that is so darn good, that has 2 losses on this year. It won't be in playoff contention, but absolutely has what it takes to compete in a Rose Bowl or win a Rose Bowl at this point. And I think they're going to bring that energy, that hatred, that vitriol into Autzen Stadium.
Yeah, and, you know, they've got a lot of key players that were on that team last year. I know you lose Brendan Covey. You know, you don't, thankfully, don't have to worry about having to kick it right to him in the return game again. But Cam Rising returning at quarterback, he's damn good. A lot of the weapons, and most importantly, you know, this is a team I think at week one, a lot of people dismissed, just like us, after their first loss going on the road and losing at Florida. But I mean, that was a lot closer game than I think, you know, people really were willing to give it credit for. And having to go all that way across the country, I don't think, again, people just like us, a lot of people don't give that enough credit for what it takes and how tough that makes your team possibly moving forward. Now, you know, here's the other thing. Their offensive coordinator is former Duck offensive coordinator out here, guy that was just there are some of those years that Sandy was here, you know, calling up some plays before Chip got here. And you have to think that he's got it out for Oregon as much as anybody, you know, that you add a little extra creativity and, you know, maybe a couple wrinkles here and there for a former team. So something to keep in mind. And I mean, I'm excited for this matchup. I know, you know, there's been a lot of negativity out there. A lot of people, you know, we just briefly talked about it before this episode that, you know, the ticket prices have been, you know, dropping out there since the rumors of Bo Nix being hurt have, you know, kind of gone full blown. And it's interesting to see the reaction on Twitter. You know, we didn't put out a question this week because, you know, don't want to have to, you know, sort through that negativity, you know, but as always, leave us a comment in the replies. Let us know what you think of this episode, who you want. But man, it's just been interesting to see overall the amount of, I guess, the fans, I guess, nervousness level that was already probably pretty high for this game, just kind of skyrocketing. It's almost like some fans have seen this game play out two times last year and have lost hope in this team and the ability of this team to maybe have had that simmering for over a year and the value that might have.
Well, we can look back at those games last year, and while everybody in a Utah uniform basically outperformed everyone in Oregon uniform for both of those games, there were two guys that really, really hurt the Ducks. Now, the good news, Devin Lloyd's a Jaguar. He plays in Jacksonville. Yeah. That's not something Oregon has to be concerned about. But Travion Thomas still very much runs the ball for Utah. He has 632 yards on the season as of right now. He's averaging 5.1 yards per attempt. He's got 7 touchdowns to lead that team as well. They are very, very good at what they do. And what does Utah like to do? Utah probably won't beat you the way Washington does. They're probably not going to say, hey, Cam, throw this 75-yard touchdown for us really quick. It's not really what they do. But what do they do? They will run it down your throat. They will let Thomas do everything he wants to do to you. When you're busy worried about him, all of a sudden Cam Rising is squirted out down the sideline. He's running past your guys as well. And what really terrifies me is that they're going to exploit the exact parts of the field that have been a problem for Oregon defensively all season long. They're going to get outside the numbers. They are going to get balls out to the flat, and they are going to run crossing and underneath routes all day long. Based on how this Oregon defense has approached those type of things this season, you have to hope it's going to be a very good week in practice.
Yeah. Well, and you know, Cam does a lot. He's not quite the runner that Bo Nix is, but damn, he can scoot. And, you know, he can hurt you really, really bad, but that's a vital piece of our offense, I think, that needs to be intact. Even if, you know, Bo isn't able to get out there and go, being able to run with the quarterback in this game is going to be huge. Their ability to game plan us last year so much was all dependent on making our quarterback, Anthony Brown, uncomfortable, which he was the entire game. And the easiest way to do that is move the quarterback. Make sure they feel confident that if they don't get to their second read in time and, you know, things aren't working out, have the ability to run and trust your offensive line in the pocket when you need to, but especially have that confidence that, hey, you know what? I'm going to be all right. I've been coached to do the right things. Take what I can get, give yourself up, and get the yards you can get and get down. And honestly, that can be so effective against an offense like this because that they schemed us up damn good last year, even more on the offensive side of the football, running away from Kayvon Thibodeau, Austin, you know, getting them to put him in situations where we're just dropping him in coverage because we don't know what else to do with him to get him involved in the play side. And honestly, it worked not just once, but twice in 3 weeks. And man, that is this is not something you're used to seeing if you're an Oregon fan or any fan. So I understand why a lot of people are deflated, but again, it's exciting. It's an opportunity for somebody to step up, you know, and we've got a lot of playmakers. I mean, we've had a couple tight ends that have been a little quiet for a little bit. I expect maybe we could have a bust out game from one of them. You know, always Troy Franklin's threat, but again, it's all going to start at the quarterback position. And again, like you said, the work that they put in practice this week is going to tell you a lot.
Nick, I think there's so many ways that we could do this last segment that we normally do this last segment. I think I'm going to pose it to you slightly differently this time. We always talk about what both teams bring to the table and then what we think is going to happen. I think what I want to do here is ask you, first and foremost, because we'll do both. First, what the best case scenario of this looks like. How Oregon can come out offensively, do what they need to do, how the defense can improve in 7 days' time, and what that looks like. And then afterwards, after we can give our answers about that, we'll get into what the vice versa that looks like, what the real inverse color effect would do to this Oregon team. And after that, we can get to our predictions where we feel it falls most likely. But circle back around to that first part. What is the best case scenario for this weekend look like for the Oregon Ducks?
I love this idea, and especially the idea that somebody might just be skimming through this podcast and just get to this part out of context and just think this is my prediction. So I'm going to go really extra with it. This Saturday, best case scenario, Ty Thompson is your Oregon starter. He comes out, he lights up the scoreboard just like Bo Nix would, with 5 touchdowns, 4 through the air, 1 on the ground, over 100 yards rushing, over 400 yards passing. The vision at quarterback is clear into the future. We use that momentum off a 32-point win against Utah to roll up to Corvallis, completely put it to them, not even close to a game. We roll into the Pac-12 championship against USC, UCLA. Who cares? Maybe like best case scenario, easy. Let's get another round against UW. This time, Ty Thompson's ready. He's prepared. He comes out. He is your Pac-12 championship game MVP. Rolling into the Rose Bowl, which we go and win by a landslide. And then next year, we just dominate everything, win the college football playoff. Ty Thompson's a Heisman contender. We have Dante Moore coming in, learning everything on the bench. This is the perfect scenario, Sam. And it all starts with us just getting that 32-point win against Utah on Saturday in Autzen Stadium.
Well, I think the mistake that I made was that I prefaced it as possible and not plausible. But you are right. That is the best possible case scenario. You're absolutely right about that. I'll use the plausible just because that was a lot of fun. But we all know that I'm the bubble burster of the group, of the duo. And
hey, when it happens, bro,
I will retweet this clip for days. Don't worry. I really will. People don't understand how often. And let's be frank. I'm not negative nearly as much as sometimes I want to be on here. I'm really not. Most of the time, I end up being positive. And all 4 occasions since we started this podcast where I've picked the team that is in Oregon, I think only one of those was I like really wrong, and that was the Ohio State game. And I was so happy to be wrong. I called you saying, I'm so happy I'm wrong right now. Thank God I'm wrong. I would love to be wrong. I would love to be wrong right now, too. And I especially hope to be wrong when we get to our worst-case scenario. But best-case scenario, I do see a way in which Oregon is able to get a victory over Utah. I see it. It happens if Oregon makes it as short a game as possible. They are as technically proficient at running the ball as they have been all season. Thompson doesn't – and I think this will be the key for Ty regardless – don't do anything drastically horrible. Don't. Bad things happen all the time, no matter what. But God, don't make everybody in the building groan at once, if at all possible. Don't. Don't throw it to the other team. Don't drop a snap for a random reason. Don't slip on 4th and 1 in the other team's territory. It's like normal things that would make everybody groan. Don't do that. And I think Oregon does have a legit shot at this game. If you can get Bucky Irving and Noah Whittington both up over 100 again, give them both around 20 touches each, kill that game, slow it down. I really think there is a chance Oregon, if they're going to win this game, it's going to be a real old school SEC 3 yards and a cloud of dust type of ball game that they win. Do I think that happens? We'll see. But that is the best case scenario. I'd be curious to hear from you, Nick, because this is what was a point that I was curious about and didn't get answered. In this best case scenario situation, what does Oregon's defense do in 7 days to go from 500 plus yards on them to not?
They show up in support of Ty Thompson. No, at this point, you know, again, I think as an offensive guy, but you have to not make mistakes on your own end. If we're being serious, you know, Oregon has to limit the amount of mistakes they have and then force Utah into situations where they make more mistakes. How do you do that? You win on first down, you put them in, you know, if you're down in distance is over, you know, if you've got 8 yards left, you know, on second or third down, you're going to be putting those passing scenarios a little bit more. And when you know that, and you can, you know, dictate what you're going to do to the offense on defense instead of vice versa. Now, if you give up, you know, an 8 yard pass play on first down, you throw that out the window. The offense is now dictating whatever they want to you on second down. So the important thing, I think, for the defense isn't at the end of the day looking at total yards given up. It's, can you create turnovers? Can we get some pressure on the quarterback? And most importantly, just try to control the scenario where you are dictating things to the offense instead of vice versa. Because, man, we've seen it too many times when this defense is, oh, we think we got him, and gives up a big play. Oh, we think we got him, and gives a short down in a run-stopping situation that we handled perfectly on first down a couple plays before to the same play, same matchup. So it's just one of those things where we've seen moments that this defense can play. It's just it hasn't been consistent. So put it all together for one game, and I think, you know, you could really – I mean, I still plausibly think we could show up Utah in this game, but it would take a significant – effort on the defensive end to minimize those mistakes that we've had of giving up, you know, big plays to either on first down or when it's, you know, third or fourth.
May I also amend very quickly before we go into the worst case scenario that part of my best case scenario, the very best case scenario is one in which Chris Hudson's interview was 100% smokescreens, in which case that is the greatest interview ever given by anybody ever. But if it's not, then, you know, a whole lot more has to be said for slowing it down, the run game, and being able to do something outside of just tackle the guy once he gets the ball in your zone. Moving on now to the darker side of the coin. What is the worst case scenario that can come out of this, Nick Cody?
By that,
I don't just mean getting our mentions filled up for about two straight days.
I was going to say the world ends tomorrow, the end, but that's not it. No, I believe we will get to that 7 p.m. kickoff one way or the other. There will probably be some Pac-12 after dark weirdness, and the worst possible scenario of that would be a flashback to that 2007 season. Everything comes out. Bo Nix is warming up, looks fine, doesn't even look like he has a limp. And then all of a sudden, in open field with nobody even near him, goes to make a cut. And that Autzen field and something isn't right. And then you put in a quarterback in a scenario like that where it's quiet, dead quiet in Autzen Stadium. All you hear is the Utah fans. And then he's expected to go out there, try and win you the game, regardless of what the score is at that time. This is going to be the worst case scenario to put anybody in. And then from there, multiple turnovers, multiple, you know, snaps over the head, errant stuff, weird things with cadence, the ball being snapped early. It all goes horribly wrong. We lose by 32 points to Utah, then go on, lose to the Beavers, lose whatever bowl game we end up playing in. Dillingham goes to coach ASU. Dan Lanning ends up lying to us and going to Auburn. Everything's in shambles, Sam. And then they hire me as head coach. That's your worst case scenario.
I thought that was starting scary. That ended scary. My goodness. Good Lord. Even if that case scenario comes to unfold, you guys can absolutely expect Once a Duck Live from the Vegas Bowl 100% would happen if that case scenario came to fruition. And plus, I think that's an SEC matchup. It could still be a lot of fun. And I hate to say it, but my Oregon versus Miami Holiday Bowl prediction from last year is still kind of in play right now.
Oof. Yikes. Yeah, well, I mean, I'll go back to real world ending over any of those scenarios.
All right. Well, you know what? We've talked about all the scenarios. Well, not all, but you know, the ones that we want to talk about. So now it's time. Predictions. Oregon versus Utah. Ducks and Utes. 7:30 from Eugene. ESPN. What goes down, Nick?
Man, I hate this part, so I'll just keep it clean and simple. I think Oregon's winning this one. Somehow, some way. I don't care how we get it done, but I expect a lot of it to come up front, both sides, defensive, offensive line, got to get it done. I got it. Oregon 38, Utah Utes 27, still a double-digit win. Oregon swaps places with them in the top 10, and, man, takes it up to a tough, tough Corvallis situation where those Beavs have been looking forward to this game all year. What do you think, Sam?
Nick, I wish I shared your optimism. Kind of in general, if we're being real. But as far as this game is concerned, again, unless there were tremendous smoke screens, and I think that a Bo Nix-led Oregon team plays one of the most fantastic Pac-12 games we've seen of the season against Utah. I really think they would. I wouldn't be shocked if this was a game that Oregon had almost been looking forward to a little bit, at considering the recent success over UW and the recent tribulations against Utah. But I think without that Heisman win quarterback, it's just a little bit too much to expect to keep your offense on the field the whole time, to expect to keep Utah's offense off the field as much as you would like to. Final score, unless there's some drastic change that we aren't aware of on Thursday that occurs by Saturday, I'm going to say the Utah Utes come into Eugene and get a 38-24 victory.
Ooh.
I think that it's going to be it would be a game that you see some, it would be contested, it would be back and forth. I'd feel not great about that 24 number for Oregon, because it really does just take a quarterback having a little bit better of a day or running backs having a little bit worse of a day for that to drastically change either direction. But again, I would love to be wrong. Please put me down as wrong for this one. Yeah, on Saturday night at 11 p.m. when this one wraps up, I really pray that I'm eating crow. But I just don't see it this week. A lot to fight for, a lot still to play for, a lot of scenarios even if this comes into play and Oregon isn't able to get this win. But just have a hard time seeing it this week.
Well, damn, Sam. I can't believe you let UW bring you down like that, but hey, you know, I understand it's hard to be this positive and it's not worth the CTE. So I get it. Not everybody can keep this optimistic outlook up all the time, but I still have faith, man, everything. And it would be a completely different situation, I think, if we had a coaching staff that was sitting there saying things like, well, we just got to be tougher, we got to want it more. Everything Lanning has said out there has made me so supremely confident in their ability to address the matters that put Ty in a bad situation, that put our kickers in a bad situation, and everything that they can do to put them in the best situation to beat Utah, man. I'm expecting it this Saturday. And hey, everybody out there, let us know, either one of us, somebody's going to be wrong. We don't often disagree. So whoever is wrong, let us hear about it. And hey, either way, hope to see you guys at the game. I know I'll be there, and once a duck, always a duck.